starting with Judas, and then 10 of the 12 as they ran away, and finally Peter, all turning their back on their only hope. And then we see the entire nation of Israel turning their back on their hope as they shout, "Crucify him," led by their religious leaders who would also turn their back on their only hope. And then, just to show not just them, but they brought in some Gentiles, right, to help out, to get them to turn their back on their only hope as well. And then moving on, just kind of sliding through these passages a little bit, toward the end of 22, we see God put on trial. Chapter 22, verse 26, first before the council, then before Pilate and Herod. Pilate tries to wiggle out of this. He's wants to let Jesus go, but fear for his own position. He wasn't really afraid of the people, what they would do, like they couldn't overthrow him. He had the Roman army behind him, but too much turmoil might cause him to lose his job. So the life of one man doesn't seem that big a deal. He caves. Then there's Herod, and Herod was all anxious to see Jesus. Maybe he'll do a magic trick. He'd heard this stuff that Jesus could do. But we know Herod's character, right? Herod was the same man that killed John the Baptist. And he and Pilate become new best friends, and these two scheming corporate ladder-climbing cowards allow the Jewish mob to get what they want. And so we get the Barabbas, and Pilate releases a murderer and sentences an innocent man to death. And then the cross is placed on Jesus, and he is led toward his death. And remember, again, this is a body that was beaten and bleeding and battered. And so we get to chapter 23 and verse 26, and I just absolutely love this scene. There's Simon of Cyrene who's been out in the country, right? He probably doesn't know what's going on, and he sees a crowd. So what do? You go over to the crowd to see what's happening, and they yank him out of the crowd, and they put this cross on his back, and he probably thinks he's going to be crucified. And the reason I love this scene, it's as if God, while observing this and thinking, why would they do that? He's innocent. Jesus is the criminal. It's as if God hit the pause button and said, any of you should go before him. All of you are more guilty than him. There's no innocent person to pluck from the crowd. They're all guilty. You're all guilty. But Simon does not get crucified. It is Jesus who is crucified, and he's hanging from the cross, placed between two thieves. One who mocks him, one who reveres him. One who took his last breath and took his next breath in hell, and the other who was that day with Jesus in paradise. And I love what St. Augustine said. One thief was saved that we might have hope. The other was not, so that we would never presume. Then at the sixth hour, which would be noon, there was darkness over the whole land as the light of the sun failed. Think about those words just for a moment. The light of the sun failed. And then at 3 p.m. when the light came back, Jesus says, and I love this also, in a loud voice, Jesus was in control. Jesus was controlling. He went willingly, and he was in control of the moment of his death. He says in a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And if you look at that verse, you'll see it's ended with an exclamation point. Jesus takes his last breath at the time so ordained by the Father and at the time of his own doing. Then he's taken down and he's placed in that cold, dark tomb. And light and darkness have such great meaning. In Matthew, we get this quote from Isaiah, the people dwelling in darkness have seen a great light. And Jesus said, if your eye is bad, your whole body is full of darkness. And in Mark, it tells us, while it was dark, Jesus went out to a desolate place and prayed. And then there's the things we've heard from our friend Luke, Zechariah's prophecy over John the Baptist, that he would be the forerunner of the one to give light to those who sit in darkness and the shadow of death. And Jesus would say, if your whole body is full of light, having no part dark, it will be completely bright. In our passage today, we heard Jesus say to the chief priests and the thugs they had with them, this, in the middle of the night, with nobody else around, with no light, this is your hour, the power of darkness. And John, the Gospel of John opens, right, talking about the light of the world. And it says something that's a foretelling of what's going to happen in a couple of days here. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And then we all know John 3:16, right? But if you go right past that, one of our favorite verses, John 3:19 says, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works are evil. Further, John says, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And this, I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. We don't have to remain in darkness, but friends, we at times have to go through darkness. We see this in our own lives from time to time. Nothing as dramatic or as important as the death of Christ, but we see darkness in our own lives. In a diagnosis, a child who's wandered far from the Lord, in the death of a loved one. It's not always death, but it is the shadow of death. Referred to in the psalm, the valley of the shadow of death. It's the place you go to where the pall of death is hanging over where you are. Death is imminent, casting a gloomy shadow. So if you turn with me back to Psalm 22, 23, and 24, we'll do those in order. Not reading the whole things, but Psalm 22, known as the Psalm of the Cross, and if you've never heard that or if you haven't read it in a while, I would encourage you to spend some time this afternoon reading this. And Jesus, who inspired these words to David, knowing that this is what's coming. When he was praying in the garden, he knew this was coming. My God, why have you forsaken me? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. These were realities that, to some extent in the life of David, but it was what was coming for Jesus. And then over to Psalm 23, that very familiar psalm. You wonder if Jesus wasn't thinking these words exactly, because we don't know. But we know he knew that which inspired these words. That was reality for Jesus. He didn't have to read these words to understand them. But you wonder if that moment before the disciples kind of messed up the whole thing, if that moment when that long-awaited Passover meal was being celebrated, the thing Jesus had wanted to do, if this was a moment of green pasture and still water for him. And while he was praying in agony and bleeding through his sweat in the garden, did not God restore his soul? Jesus' body remained in agony. His emotions were still ragged, but God sent an angel to him to restore his soul, to enable him to stand and move forward in the Father's will. And where did he go? Straight into that valley of the shadow of death, with no fear of evil. Look at Psalm 24, verse 3. When Jesus ascended that hill we call Mount Calvary, he stood in the holiest place. The only one that ever could, because the only person that this describes accurately, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, who shall stand in his holy place, he who has clean hands and a pure heart. We all want to desire to have clean hands and a pure heart, but we all have impure hearts and dirty hands. Only Jesus had clean hands and a pure heart. Only Jesus could ascend Calvary and do any good for mankind. No one else could have done that. So we're entering into this over these next however long it takes us, this look at the cross. We're going to plumb the depths of the cross. We're going to, as the old hymn says, we're going to survey the wondrous cross. We're going to look at the length and breadth and the cost and the value of the cross. We're going to learn, I hope, the great meaning that Stuart Townend had when he wrote the song that we were just singing. We're going to learn how deep the Father's love for us really is, as much as we can, that it is indeed vast beyond all measure, that he did give his only son for what? To make a wretch, right here, treasure. He makes a wretch into treasure. He makes something that's sinful and dark and ugly and worthless into something beautiful, only done through what he goes on to say, the pain of searing loss that Jesus had to experience for me to become God's treasure. He had to experience the separation. The Father turns his face away and Jesus cries, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the song goes on to say, as wounds which mar the chosen one. It's beautiful when we sing it, but it's horrific when we stop to look at it. But what do they do? Hebrews 2:10, for it was fitting that he for whom and by whom all things exist, that's Jesus, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. So behold the man upon the cross. And we're going to look closely at the cross. We're going to look at our sin on his shoulders. We're hopefully at times we're going to feel the shame of our own voice. I want to stand here and say, if I was there, I would have stood up for Jesus. But you know what? I wouldn't have. I'd been yelling, crucify him. And that phrase, his dying breath has brought me life. And then that last verse of that song is the prayer I have for all of us, that after we go through this, in steps as we go through this, that we won't boast in anything of ourselves. No gifts, no power, no wisdom, but we'll boast in Jesus Christ and his death and his resurrection. And we'll ask ourselves the question, why should I gain from his reward? Why should I get anything from this? This is a retelling of the old Wesley hymn, and can it be that I should gain? Why should I gain from his reward? I cannot give an answer. But this I know with all my heart. His wounds have paid my ransom. This cross is so important. It's more than jewelry. It's more than something that we hang or stand up in a church. I heard a pastor say this week, I was listening to a sermon, and not that there's anything wrong with having crosses in church, but his church does not have one. And he was saying, I'm glad we don't have a cross in here so that we don't get used to it. There is no the electrocution, right? People have been electrocuted to death in an electric chair, but there's no the electrocution. There's no the hanging. Oh, when we think of hanging, we think of that guy. There's no the firing squad that when we think of someone lined up for treason or whatever and shot to death, that we think of that person. But there is, although there were thousands upon thousands upon thousands of crucifixions done by the Romans, done by the Muslims, done by the Greeks, done by the Japanese, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of crucifixions, there is a single crucifixion. Even people that don't believe, when they hear the crucifixion, they think of Jesus. So it is worthwhile that we would do this. And for all of us who call ourselves by the name of Christian, I'm asking that you come with me through this as we delve into this and see what it is that Jesus really did for us. And if you're here and you're not a Christian, did he do it for you or not? At this point, it's up to you. Jesus has done what it takes to save you. Will you do what it takes to receive it? Amen.